I'm Jane Espenson.
I'm Brad Bell.
You're listening to the Rated NA Podcast.
Welcome to Rated NA, the podcast for the website nerdappropriate.com. This is episode number 115, part two of our Comic-Con 2013 special extravaganza podcast series.
Experience.
Just to be clear, it's not 115 part two. It's Comic-Con.
It's 115. Yeah, I didn't say 115 part two. This is part two of the.
Yeah.
Don't start.
There's not two 115s. That's what
Look,
I'm trying to
buddy,
say.
I said Rated NA 115, part two of the Comic-Con 20. I know what I said, all
right? Okay. You guys are both right.
Both of you are right.
We're just so familiar with each other.
Fine.
Let's do the rundown.
Anyways, we actually just recorded 114, so I don't know how much intro we want to do, but what have you guys been up to?
Well, it's been all of 48 hours.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. I've been doing
I missed you guys.
I missed you guys, too.
Oh. I missed everybody.
I've been doing some stuff for the website. Put some stuff up on the old Facebook, which is neglected frequently. So I figured I'd throw some pictures and stuff up there. So if you haven't gone over to our Facebook page, it's /nerdappropriate on Facebook. And check out some of the pictures and stuff over there.
I like that new banner. That's nice.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
I did that this afternoon and just threw some.
I'm going to hire you for graphic design from now on.
Thanks, man. You know. And other than that, I haven't really been doing a lot. I went and saw a movie with Matt, ate some burritos, and just been kind of laying low and hanging out and still recovering from Comic-Con and now getting ready for Penny Arcade Expo in Seattle.
Woo-hoo!
Ah.
Hillary, why don't you explain everything that you're doing, because you're doing a whole lot more.
Well, so
sigh.
I know. So, in addition to my real job, I'm actually coordinating and managing some of the events for BioWare, which is fantastic. One of them being PAX Prime in Seattle, and just working on pretty much a lot of events over the next like couple months or so. This weekend is GamerX in San Francisco, so that should be pretty fun and
awesome.
Amazing. And the BioWare blog has all that information. But yeah, but the PAX Prime stuff is really, really heating up. So I'm super excited about that. And my panels that I'm going to be on too. So you can find
how
me.
Many? How many?
I'm on three panels.
Whoa.
That's crazy.
Are those Grace. Heating up as well?
They are heating up. So I think there's one on Sunday at 7:30, Monday at 10, and Monday at 3. So cool. Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Monday. Awesome. This is also the first year that there's a Penny Arcade Monday. So everyone gets to be extra disgusting and zombified.
Yeah, that's cray.
It's like it's hitting Comic-Con lengths.
Yeah. You
know? I'm kind of nervous about Monday, to be honest, just because two panels on that day after having I think I get into Seattle like on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And it's just gonna be like a marathon up until that point. So by the time I hit Monday, I'll be pretty much delirious, so should make for some laughs.
There you go. Exactly.
We'll have the microphones ready.
All right.
Awesome. All right.
Scott, what about you? What are you doing?
Well, as you know, I've been playing Mass 2, my insanity run, and it's nice. I've kind of fallen
it's
off.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, well, let me explain. I've fallen off of the sort of like bleeding edge gaming curve lately, and it's
that's marketing speak, yo.
It's nice to retreat back, you know, and revisit some of these older games. And I'm, like I said, I'm learning to love Mass 2 because I didn't love it the first time. So it's good. It's a good experience. I'm enjoying it.
Awesome.
Team Vanguard.
Matt, what about you?
Yes.
What are you
doing? That's me. Scott is extra feisty today, by the way. He warned us this before the podcast.
I'm in a bad mood.
He said he's grouchy.
Already two Don't times in.
No, not in a bad mood. Maybe just grouchy. A little grouchy. Yeah.
It's feisty. I said feisty.
Feisty? I can deal with feisty.
Can we call you Plucky?
I don't even know. What does that mean?
Plucky?
You know.
Plucky is like, is sort of like feisty, but.
I feel like Plucky's a little happier, though.
Oh, is it?
Plucky
means. Yeah, it sounds a little happier.
Plucky means courage or brave. Oh. I'm not feeling courageous or brave.
Okay. So I got back from New York. I have working a whole lot the past day or so.
Have you been home for more than 4 hours?
I've been home for more than 12 hours, which is wonderful. And I'm going to take a minute to plug a thing I did because I did it and it's awesome and I'm proud of it. But if you haven't heard, I work at Showtime and I do their Showtime Anytime app, and we launched live TV on the Showtime Anytime app yesterday. So
awesome.
Super proud of it. You can go on the mobile. If you use the mobile, if you use iPad or something like that, then the API that it calls to is a thing I built. And if you use the website, then the actual whole thing is a thing I built. Not the whole thing, but the video portion.
All by yourself.
Me and one other guy did the front end. But it's I'm proud of it, and it's good, and it's fun, and you can go watch like live boxing and Dexter when it's on and all that shit. So it's cool. And no, we still don't have Time Warner, and no, it's not on the Xbox or the Roku yet. Anyways, what else? Saw Pacific Rim with Ash, finally.
Sweet.
Not finally with Ash, but I finally saw Pacific Rim, and then Ash was there.
I was waiting longingly for you.
Yeah.
We finally saw it together.
Doing the front
end. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. You know, why not? It was good. Fun movie. I also played more Swords and Sorcery, loving that game on the iPad.
I like how it's separated into like sessions.
I do too. It's nice. It kind of tells me to like, hey, you got to a good point, man. Take a break.
And yeah, I'm,
like, okay,
I'm kind of into that.
You know what else is cool? And it has sessions?
What's that?
Our episode format.
Yeah.
Well,
wow. That's,
okay, I thought you were going to go with Comic-Con, but sure.
Very technical.
It works, guys. It
works. Did. It did work.
So, Ash, why don't you tell us?
Okay,
tell us
so
what we're doing.
115 is going to be a little different, just like 114 was. But 115 is a collection of audio that I recorded at this year's Comic-Con. So we have a number of different interviews that we're going to be kind of running through, and we'll do a little bit of some bumpers in between to kind of explain the circumstances behind these interviews, because it's interesting how we get these sometimes and also where the interviews are conducted. And just, I don't know, I always like to know a little bit more. So we'll talk a little bit about these before we actually launch into them. But we chat with writer Jane Espenson for a little bit here, and this one was super special. And author Marissa Meyer. Did it again. Cast of the short film called The Sidekick, who have a lot of, you know, veterans from shows like Party Down and Key and Peele. So that was awesome. And some voice acting stuff as well. So hang in there and listen to them all, and hopefully you guys enjoy them. All right, so for those of you who don't know much about Jane Espenson is, she's been writing stuff for, I don't know, 20 plus years. And if you watch anything on television, any genre stuff, she's probably written a lot of it. She's written a lot of Warehouse 13, a lot of Battlestar Galactica, Firefly, yeah. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel. I mean, Jane Espenson's fingers are all over everything. We talked to her and Brad Bell, who also writes a web series called Husbands. So I talked to both. Did I say it again?
Just go with it. You got it.
I talked to both of them, which sounds so wrong. Both Jane Espenson and Brad Bell about their web series Husbands. And if you guys have been longtime listeners, we actually talked to Alessandra Torresani about Husbands a really long time ago. Husbands is actually coming up on season 3. There's a lot of information about Husbands in the interview, and also they just recently launched a graphic novel through Dark Horse. And this interview was done actually on the Comic-Con floor, in this little weird nook that Dark Horse had set up. It's not a long one. It's like a short 7-minute little interview, but I'm going to work really hard to get a full length Jane Espenson interview because she's, a pretty, pretty awesome person.
That'd be incredible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So enjoy.
we get started, just a little bit about ourselves and our site. So Nerd Appropriate's been around for 3 years. We're a blog and a podcast. We've been podcasting for almost 3 years. I've had the pleasure of having people like Amy Acker on the show. She's so much fun. And it was a pleasure to have her. And I actually met you, Jane, here at Comic-Con, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago. I used to carry around a Buffy yearbook that I would have everyone sign and actually have your signature on there. So I've been a fan for a very long time. And I love all your work. So this is cool for me and cool for our listeners and everything to get to, you know, hear you talk and things like that. So I'm going to have you guys introduce yourselves briefly and talk just a minute about Husbands and what's coming up maybe in the new season, Husbands.
Absolutely. My name is Jane Espenson.
And I'm Brad Bell.
You may know me from a 20-year writing career on TV, Buffy, Battlestar, Game of Thrones, Torchwood, Once Upon a Time, Once Upon a Time in Wonderland, and now Husbands. Husbands is a marriage equality comedy, a comedy about two guys who get married a little too soon. Are they going to make it?
We'll have to watch and see. yeah. And we just recently made a deal with the CW, and we will be launching on the CW Seed, which is their digital platform where they exclusively have comedy. They just started airing comedy for Whose Line Is It Anyway on their broadcast division, and now they are kind of moving into that with their brand digitally, and we are a part of that. So we'll be launching that in August with new episodes guest starring Miss Amy Acker.
And Seth Green and Michael Hogan from Battlestar Galactica and Beth Grant. Wow.
And more to be announced soon.
So I first heard about Husbands because through some fluke, we had Alessandra Torresani on right before season one launched. And it was when we were just first starting to do interviews with people, and we actually had the confidence to actually go out and talk to people. And we did a phone interview with Alessandra, and she was so incredibly passionate about the project. For people that maybe haven't seen Husbands yet, like, what would be the draw for new listeners, or new viewers rather, to Husbands?
It's funny. And it's about love, and it's about hope, and it's the show you've been waiting for. You've been waiting for a romantic comedy on television that actually speaks to what's happening in the world today. That's our show.
Yeah, and I think if you love classic sitcoms, especially like I Love Lucy or Bewitched or anything made in that vein, Dick Van Dyke, it's the 21st century version of that. It's very relevant and very fresh, and it's familiar, but it's also unlike anything ever before.
Did you have to stop and think about what century it was?
No, I sort of fumbled over the F's. I'm an F fumbler. I don't have quite a stutter, but sometimes I'm like 21st century.
I thought you were going to say 20th and realized it was we'd moved on.
No, God, 20th century? That's so last century.
So you guys were actually here at, I guess I should tell our listeners this, it's Comic-Con 2013. We're at the Dark Horse booth. We're in this nice little, like, cave they set up in the middle of the Comic-Con floor to kind of trick us into thinking we're in a safe place. You guys are here actually signing stuff for Dark Horse, so can you tell our listeners about maybe the collaboration between Husbands and Dark Horse?
Yes, at a certain point in the Husband's history, very recently, we decided we wanted to expand. We had more stories than we could tell than we could shoot. So we decided we would write them down. So we, in the way that in the show we play with sitcom tropes, we decided in the comic book to play with comic book tropes. So we told 6 little stories about Cheeks and Brady, and we put them in different comic book worlds. You know, there's a space adventure, and there's a Sherlock Holmesian kind of adventure. And we're very proud. It's a hardback collection that Dark Horse sells. And Brad and I wrote the episodes, and some amazing artists drew them.
Yeah, and it was incredible because we got to take classic archetypal relationships as well, and those dynamics like superhero, supervillain, and like you said, Sherlock and Watson, prince and princess, and it was interesting to take that with two guys and see how the dynamic changes and how it remains the same and explore relationships through that lens.
Plus, comic books are a lot of fun, so it's always nice to like move over and do stuff in the realm of comics.
Awesome.
I don't know how much time we have. He told me I have 7 minutes. I don't want to... Oh, we're getting there. Okay, so quickly, I want to ask quickly about Amy Acker's character. So I read a little bit. I didn't get a chance to make it to the panel. I might have been, I was sleeping in another part of the building someplace. But can you tell us a little bit about Amy's character in the upcoming season?
Yeah, Brad actually wrote this character for her, and she dug into it with a relic, like a girl digging into a big, thick steak. Brad, you want to tell what Claudia's like or what she's doing?
Yeah, Claudia is one of the guys, Brady, one of the husbands. He was engaged once before, and she is the ex-fiance. So when the boys decide to have a formal ceremony, because their first one accidentally happened in Vegas, so they decide to do it right and invite their family and friends, and she shows up. And I don't think she's quite over what happened between her and Brady. I think maybe she needs closure, or maybe, well, yeah, Amy's. Yeah, Amy is very good at playing the villain. And in this one, she is Venom with a lot of sugar. She's not a conspicuous villain.
She's sort of one of those victim villains, yeah. And they're the worst ones.
Well, thank you guys so much for everything, and I really appreciated talking to you guys. And look forward to Husband Season 3. When's it coming out? Season 3 very soon, right?
Yes, it'll be in August at the CWSeed.com.
And Seed is going to be their digital platform, essentially, for comedy. Awesome. Well, thank you guys again.
Okay, so that was Jane Espenson. I just wanted to briefly say how incredibly nervous I was for that interview. I actually woke up in a cold sweat at like 6 in the morning before I had to do that one. And I briefly talked about this in 114, but I had a nightmare that all my recording equipment broke and like knobs were falling off of it and I was just stumbling around. So,
aww,
yeah, it was like really, really intense too, because when I got there, I like double, triple checked all my audio stuff, because you're always afraid. Like, you know, you set these up and you work on getting everything to actually fit in your schedule. Then God forbid you get there and your fucking batteries run out or something. So it all worked. And so there it is. And I'm glad you guys enjoy it. The next one is kind of a special one because it's not really just Matt and I doing the interview. It's actually our wives.
Yeah.
This one is with author Marissa Meyer. And Marissa Meyer was incredibly gracious and was awesome during this interview. And for those of you who don't know who she is an author who wrote books like Scarlet and the upcoming Cress. And she does these really cool kind of futuristic takes on classic fairy tales.
Well, it's actually one whole series of like one world from what I understand. And it, the first one, Scarlet, is off of Red Riding Hood, I believe. And then the second one, Cinder, is Cinderella. Cress is Rapunzel.
Yeah, Rapunzel, that's right. She calls them the Lunar Chronicles, right?
Yeah, yes. The Lunar Chronicles. And, awesome. And yeah, our wives love them, which is why Ash was smart enough to bring them along for the interview. And the interview actually ended up going super well. It was really fun. She's a pretty awesome person. So
she's great. And she has a lot of the same hobbies and passions as we do. She loves, you know, fantasy, and she loves anime, and she loves, you know, Firefly and all this stuff that we are huge fans of. And of course, it was neat to get to see our wives interact with her and actually conduct this interview, which they were super nervous about, which they didn't want anyone to know, but they were super nervous.
My wife was freaking out enough that like on the way to the interview, we weren't running late, but we were going to be there like right on time, you know? And I'm like, all right, let's go meet them at the table. And Melissa was like, I'm just not going to go. And I was like, what? Like, we're on the way. She's like, no, it's fine. We're going to be super late. I don't even need to go. And I'm like, we're going. Just go. You're fine. And she's like, okay. And like walked over there and did the interview with Chris.
We should probably say, yeah, our wives' names. So you'll hear two smaller voices that are not Matt's voice and my voice. Small voice number one is my wife, Christina, and small voice number two is Matt's wife, Melissa. They are indeed sisters, if you didn't know that already. And enjoy this chat with Marissa Meyer.
We're here with Marissa Meyer, and it is we're at San Diego Comic-Con 2013, and we're here to talk about books and about writing and about Scarlet and Cinder and all sorts of fun stuff. Let's go ahead and just talk a little bit about your background and how you got your start as an author and kind of what some of your inspirations might be.
Candy, well, I have an incredibly nerdy start, in fact, as a writer. I started writing seriously when I was 14 because my best friend introduced me to Sailor Moon. And I completely fell in love with it, as you do when you're 14 years old and learn about Tuxedo Mask for the first time. And I started writing fan fiction. And I, you know, that was the first time I'd learned about fan fiction and that there were these whole, you know, archives on the internet that you could post these stories and other fans could read them. And I was like, that's the best thing ever. So I did that and I wrote fanfic all through high school and all through college. And kind of, you know, would start a novel once in a while thinking someday I want to be published. But it never really went anywhere. And I would always lose interest and go back to fan fiction until I had the idea for Cinder. And as soon as I had the idea for, you know, writing a cyborg Cinderella story, I was like, that is by far the coolest idea I have ever had. I have to write this and finish it and try to get it published. So Sailor Moon is a huge inspiration for me. And a lot of, you know, fans of Sailor Moon will read my books and they can tell, you know, you see influences in the books. And another influence for me, or two, have been Star Wars and Firefly. You know, for me, that's very much where the science fiction elements come from, and kind of that space western / space opera feel.
And I know you've already spoken a lot about the sci-fi influences with Firefly and Star Wars and all that, but what about the fairy tale influence side? And I know, like, I'm super Disney nerd. Like, it's all I watched growing up as a kid. I know, like, I can recite, like, Disney movies from start to finish and sing the songs and everything. So I was kind of, like, wondering, like, where all the fairy tale influences came from, if, you know, something similar, and also why those four fairy tale characters. Because, you know, I know everyone has their favorite fairy tale characters, so I'm wondering why did you pick those four as the ones to focus on?
Yeah, I mean, I am so... Disney, that's what we grew up with, was Disney. And for me, like, I have been in love with fairy tales since I was a kid, and I can really trace it back to I was 5 years old and went to see The Little Mermaid in theaters. And of course it's this, you know, life-changing moment when it's the first movie I ever saw in theaters, and it's the happily ever after and this beautiful story. Well, a little while later, my grandma gave me a little book of fairy tales, and the first story in that book was Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Mermaid. And I read it, and it is nothing at all like the Disney story. And my little 5-year-old self was devastated and like, what is this? And so I think that is kind of what started this fascination with fairy tales and like this idea of what is Disney not telling us? Like, there is clearly more to these stories. And so I got really interested in the old, the Grimm tales and the Hans Christian Andersen tales, you know, way back when I was a kid, and that just never really left me. And then I studied them in college and took some courses on them and loved reading retellings, you know, once I learned about Gail Carson Levine and some of these, you know, great writers who take the stories and, you know, expand on them. Exactly. And I just thought that was such a fascinating thing, that you could take these stories that are hundreds of years old and have been done so many times, but still find a really unique twist to give them.
That's one of my favorite things. I went to a writer's camp in the fourth grade when I lived in Washington, D.C., and my dad went with me, of course, because, you know, we're children, and it was one of my favorite exercises was to take, you know, a favorite story and turn it around, and it was, you know, before I knew about anything like that. So for me, my dad, you know, me and my, I think I had like another like child writer with me, and it was a partner and our parents, and we took Wizard of Oz and made it like Dorothy was a fugitive on the run, and like, you know, the Scarecrow and the Lion were aiding and abetting, you know. It was like, and we just made this giant like story, like, that, you know, flipped it around, that they weren't the heroes and like trying to find, you know, try to find their way home. They were actually like, we're like, you know, running through, and she stole the ruby slippers, and it was like a really fun exercise. So yeah, it was, as soon as I read Cinder, I was like, oh my god, it brought back all those childhood memories for me. So that's awesome. It's really fun. So just a compliment.
Yeah. I'm gonna embarrass them for
yeah,
a second.
Sure.
So we play Dungeons and Dragons, and they, yeah. I think both of them have characters that are loosely based on characters you've created in our D&D campaign.
Our D&D character's name is Rose, based on Rose. On Scarlet, and mine is Lynn,
yeah,
based on Cinder.
Yeah. They're pretty cool characters, too.
The first people I've ever heard that have played Dungeons and Dragons character.
There you go. I didn't know if they were going to bring it up, but I figured I would put them on the spot.
I didn't even think of it.
Yeah.
It's just second nature.
I
just were like, oh yeah, that's right. It is related.
We did that. Yeah.
So you can continue. Now that I've embarrassed you.
The parts in the book where you've definitely mixed a lot of sci-fi in there, and there's also like supernatural, like sort of werewolves and things like that. And I know like a lot of the characters have their own little abilities. Even if they're not supernatural, they do have an ability that makes them unique and strong.
Like
what
thorns.
Other supernatural or
who we love?
Yeah. But what other supernatural or, you know, those kind of unique ability things can we see in some of the last two books?
Well, probably the most obvious one is Cress, who book three is based on, who is my Rapunzel character, who is a fabulous computer hacker. And so that's kind of her special skill.
I just got chills. It is who I think it is.
Yes, it is Rapunzel. I love Rapunzel. And then you'll see a lot more of Captain Thorn as well in book three and the whole series. But he really gets to shine in book three. But as far as other special skills, Princess Winter is Snow White, so the main character of the fourth book. And she doesn't have a specific, you know, talent like the first three girls do. But for her, I think that her strength lies more in really more of a traditional, like, fairy tale princess, her goodness and, you know, her desire to help the people who are being oppressed by her stepmother, the evil queen, Lavanna. And so she kind of has more of a softer talent and more of, like, diplomacy, I suppose you could call it. But, yeah, so that and computer hacking, you know, what else do you need?
The other two characters, if I'm correct, we've already seen a hint of the Rapunzel-based character in Cinder. Have we seen any hint of the Snow White character, or is she going to be brand new in the fourth book?
You know, the only mention she's had was in Cinder, she was just mentioned, like, as a passing comment about Princess Winter. But you haven't seen her yet. You will see her in book three. You'll also meet the hero of book four in book three. So by the end of book three, we'll have the full cast aligned and ready to save the world.
Be like, we're going for it, like, exactly. All out.
Yeah. So... And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know if there is a talk of making Cinder into a movie. Who is your dream person that you would cast as Cinder and Prince Guy, especially, because we talk about this quite often.
Yes, well, I mean, we'll start by saying that the rights have been optioned. Yay, thank you. I'm so excited. So that's, you know, we'll see. Fingers are crossed. I would love it to happen. As far as who I would cast, this question comes up all the time, and I'm really bad. Like, I don't really have, like, a solid pop culture reference, but there's been a lot of fan castings popping up on the internet, and one of the best I've seen for Cinder is Shay Mitchell, who is in Pretty Little Liars. She fits my vision for Cinder. And then Prince Kai, like, there's not a lot of young Asian actors. It's hard to pinpoint.
Yeah.
One that I had in mind long ago was, gosh, I don't even know his real name, but he plays Mike Chang in Glee. Yeah.
Yes. We're like,
he could be him. He could be Kai. He could, and, you know, he dances. Harry Shum, that's right. Oh, and another fan casting that I love is Emma Stone for Scarlett.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, because she's kind of got that tough girl.
Yeah, she totally got the attitude down.
I think Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson could be Cinder and Kai.
Anything with that, anything.
That's actually a really good segue. You're great at segues. You should do this professionally. The supernatural romance has become a very popular genre. I mean, it's been popular for a really long time, but in the past, you know, 5-6 years, it's gone crazy. And for those of us that have been coming to Comic-Con for a while, when Twilight was here, it was
it was insane. Yeah, it was just absolutely insane. People would camp out for days and days and days and overnight, and just like they would literally bring like sleeping bags and things like that and just stay to see, you know, the Twilight cast. So, you said you were inspired by things like Sailor Moon and Disney cartoons, things like that. But how do you feel about the supernatural romance genre right now? Do you feel like it's going to reach its apex and then it's going to start to die out? Or do you think we haven't seen the best yet?
Well, I mean, I guess it kind of depends on how you're categorizing supernatural romance, because to me that's, you know, the vampires and the werewolves, and that's supernatural. And as far as that goes, I mean, we're always going to have vampires, we're always going to have werewolves. It's just a part of our culture and storytelling. But I do think that as far as young adult goes, that it pretty much peaked, I think, with Twilight and Vampire Diaries, and I do think that it is going to be trailing off, and I think we've seen it trailing off, you know, now with, you know, Hunger Games and Divergent are rising up to take that place, and so it's much more, you know, dystopian focused, and of course my fingers are crossed that sci-fi is the next big thing, you know, so yeah, Ender's Game, and you are definitely seeing a lot of a sci-fi revival, in young adults specifically, so you know, trends come and go. I don't think we'll ever be, you know, done with supernatural romance, but I don't think that it's, you know, continuing on the same wavelength that it has been.
Well, I definitely think that you bridge the gap between some of those things that, you know, obviously bringing cyborg and things like that of, you know, of sci-fi nature and even, you know, I guess science fiction because they're, you know, in outer space and that sort of thing. For me, it was my first taste into that as I read high fantasy, I love fairy tales and that sort of thing. So for you to kind of bridge those two together, it has opened my world to so many other books. So I thank you very much for doing that. And it's like, you know, when people ask, like, oh, what is it about? I said, you know, one, it's a really easy, really fun, action-packed read. And, I mean, it constantly... Just to give you another little nerd side story, my sister and I were so enamored with these books that in order for me to read them faster,
I fly through books, so I read it, and then I'm, like, dying to talk to somebody about it, so I'm like, read faster!
So in order to do this, while I was driving and she was in the passenger seat, we would read out loud to each other to get the book finished. We also...
Okay, so she liked to read the Scarlet parts, yes. And I like to read the Cinder parts, you know, give each other a break, because it's every couple chapters or so, and, you know, every once in a while we'd use voice and then
and
also
Foley.
Add in like Foley side effects, like when she threw her like her calm on the floor of the car, like, at her spaceship, and I like threw something in the car, and I'm like, yeah.
It was like she sat down with a hump, and we're like
so we definitely I want this. It's like I want this book to become alive, you know. So it's like, well, there's no movie yet, and I'm just going to act it out myself.
Yeah. Awesome. So, yes, we are very enamored with your writing. You mentioned home. Where are you based?
Tacoma, Washington.
And how does that influence your writing at all? Like, do you pull from home? Because, you know, like, Grimm is set in Portland and that sort of thing. Do you pull from your home at all?
Not intentionally. In, you know, Tacoma, very close to Seattle. And so, you know, very rainy, as, you know, as people know. And I love writing when it's raining outside. So I feel like there's a part of that. And it's a very creative community up there. Lots of writers, lots of young adult writers. And so it's a great community for being where I am. And so there's that aspect as far as how it influences me as just a general writer. But I have not set anything even in America yet. And so I wouldn't say that it really influences beyond that.
And that kind of leads me into the next thing I was curious about is we've seen a lot of New Beijing, we've seen a lot of the European Federation, and I know eventually she's probably going to be making her way to Africa, I'm assuming, to see Dr. Erlin. Are we going to get to see all of the areas of this new world, or are you going to just kind of stick to those major areas?
At this point, it'll just be those three countries, so Africa, Europe and the Eastern Commonwealth. That's fine. New Beijing. Well, no, New Beijing is the city, the capital city. Right, okay. So you're not incorrect. Yeah, and I thought, like, I would love to show the Americas and Australia are the missing two, but they have not worked their way into these four books. Maybe someday they'll do a tie-in or a spin-off, or who knows? You know, who knows where inspiration will lead, but... yeah, because I think it'd be fun to show them. And Captain Thorne is from America. He's actually from L.A. So, you know, I could do something like that. You're like, yes, we know.
More on Luna as well, right?
Yes, book four is almost entirely on Luna.
Mm-hmm. I know, because I also read The Queen's Army, the little, like, prequel about, like, Wolf's kind of past. Background. And I was like... Why is it done? No, there needs to be more of this. I need to know more about Wolf.
Right.
So, like, I'm really excited to go back to Luna and kind of see what that world is like.
Thank you. I'm excited. It's been a lot of fun to write and to, you know, it's the first world building I've done where I didn't have influences, you know, from, you know, Asian cultures and European cultures and whatnot. So it's like creating something brand new, which has its challenges. You know, it can be a struggle at times, but it's also a lot of fun.
With Cinder being, was your debut novel, right? It was your first. I kind of want to know, or... not know, but I kind of wanted you to kind of maybe give advice to other young writers or people that are coming out with first book, like how you navigated the waters of publishing and kind of getting that first step, because it's not always easy to get people to just pay attention to you, let alone like put something out through a major channel. And I didn't know if you had advice for young authors or new authors for that matter, young or old, I guess, about that.
Yeah, well, of course, I mean, the major most important thing you can do is just write a great book, and it's surprising to me, I think a lot of writers ignore that step, you know, and it's really hard. I understand that when you have this dream of getting published, you know, you want to rush, you want to jump into it and start the querying process, even though you may not be ready and your book may not be ready, and it can be really, really difficult to be patient. But so that's always the first thing I tell aspiring writers, you know, learn your craft, take your time, get the book critiqued by trusted readers, make sure you've written the best thing you can write before you try to get it published. Did you?
Well, you mentioned writing groups. I know how this works. You mentioned writing groups. Did you have like a mentor kind of that you dealt with, or was it a whole group of people that you kind of passed things back and forth?
I was lucky that I had a group of really amazing readers, all that I'd met through fan fiction. So people who had, you know, become fans of my fanfics over time and had become critique partners for those. And then eventually I was like, hey, I'm working on a novel. Do you want to read that too? And of course they did and offered just phenomenal advice. At that point, when I was first writing Cinder, I think I had 7 people read the manuscript and offer feedback. Now I'm down to 3. I have 3 readers who read every manuscript and offer feedback. And they will always find stuff that you never even would have thought of. I mean, it's so necessary to have somebody look at it and give you that feedback. So that's the number one most important thing you can do is just write a great book. Because we were in a panel today with Marie Lu and her agent and editor, and they were talking about, you know, the querying process. And her agent said that her agency receives, I believe it was 36,000 queries every year, or they received that many last year, and they signed 7 authors out of that. So it's insane. You know, you really have to create a product that is going to stand above everything else out there. Yeah, something that, yeah, is unique and well-written and, yeah. So that's the number one. After you've gotten past that stage, you know, once you get an agent, usually through the querying process is the most common way, it's their job to sell the book to a publisher. So, you know, educate yourself about the process, know kind of how it works and what an agent's job is, what an editor's job is. But really at that point, it's pretty much out of your hands until you have a book deal. And at that point, so much of it becomes just trying to enjoy the process and publicity and marketing. And you get a publicist. Your editor will keep you in contact with the marketing department, so they kind of, you know, hold your hand through a lot of it. But anytime you can educate yourself, you know, get on Twitter, be on Facebook. If you're comfortable blogging or vlogging or anything, you know, do that, but don't force yourself to do something that you hate. There's a lot of resources out there and a lot of ways that you can connect with readership these days. We live in a time when it's really easy to connect to your readers and your fans, and that's awesome. And I think that debut authors should definitely be taking advantage of that, not only because it helps to sell books, but also because it's really fun meeting readers. So why wouldn't you do it?
Your D&D characters after your characters.
Yes.
Just one more question about, because now you've talked about the kind of process about after you've written the book, but specifically to your story arc of the four books, how much of it did you map out to start out with, and how much of it have you kind of, like, when you get the feedback from, you know, the people that you've shared your manuscripts with, how much of it have you kind of tweaked along the way?
And if by tweaked you mean changed completely. I'm an outliner, so I knew really early on this was going to be a four-book series. I knew which fairy tales I was going to base it off of. And I did outline every book in the series. Of course, Cinder's and Scarlet's outlines were very detailed. And then Crest and Winter were more just like, I kind of think something sort of like this will happen. But I did have an idea of where the story was heading from the very beginning. But then I wrote Cinder, Scarlet, Crest all kind of back-to-back. And then I went back to revise Cinder, and everything changed. So it was one of those things, like, you know, you still have the iconic Cinderella moment. So she's still a cyborg. There's still a ball. There's still a prince. You know, those things. Yeah, the slipper. So a lot of things stayed the same, but completely different villain in the original one. You weren't going to meet the queen until book four. And so book one had an entirely different villain. So, like, okay, I got rid of that character, you know, changed Cinder's relationship with Peony. Her little sister changed completely. A lot of things changed. And of course, after that happened, everything that I'd written for books two and three were like, well, those don't work anymore. So it's a lot for me. The first draft is all about kind of figuring out the characters and just getting the initial idea down on paper, and then going back and reading it and figuring out, okay, what is wrong with this? What can I do to make it better? And things do change a lot over multiple drafts.
Are you a traditional pen and paper kind of person, or do you download everything on your comm and send it to your port screen?
Gosh, I wish I had one of those. If they could do holographs, then iPhones would pretty much be, you know, they can basically just do it everything. Yeah. What was the question?
Pen and paper.
No, I always type. I'm a type person. But I do brainstorm longhand. So if I'm ever stuck on something, then I'll use pen and paper to kind of work through it.
I happen across, you have a website that you do everything for it. But so people can go to that, and it I believe it's www.marissameyer.com. Yep. MarissaMeyer.com. All right. Is there anywhere else that fans can find you or find out information, especially since, you know, your book's coming up next year, you know, and I'm already super excited about it. I'm like, okay, I can wait. But is there, like, you know, a Twitter or a Facebook or anything like that where fans can find you and find out information?
Yeah, I think the website's definitely the number one. That's where I have my blog and my quarterly newsletter. So pretty much any big announcements are going to be on those. But beyond that, I have a Facebook page. It's just Marissa Meyer Author. My publisher runs a Lunar Chronicles page, which is Lunar Chronicles on Facebook. So those are two great resources. And then I am on Twitter. It's at Marissa_Meyer.
And I'm not trying to rush you or, you know, anything like that, but because I know, you know, we still have Cress and the fourth book coming out. But is there anything in the back of your mind as
a different upcoming project that you have kind of in the works.
Yes, in fact, I have just recently sold 2 new books to my publisher. Thank you. I'm very excited. They are both going to be very different from the Lunar Chronicles. The first will be a YA fantasy standalone. After that one, we actually haven't officially decided what the follow-up book will be, but the idea I'm leaning toward most will be an action adventure, contemporary action adventure, and that may be a standalone or might become another series, because sometimes I start writing and it just keeps going. So we'll see. But yeah, so those are in the works, and I have a draft written of the fantasy one, and I'm excited about it. Yeah. Yeah. And that should be out in fall 2015.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, thank you so very much. It was an absolute pleasure. I feel like we're like BFFs now. It was like... Right. But I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and letting like the whole
family
come along. So we appreciate it very much.
So the thing that I really liked about that interview is that it were your wives that were doing the gushing and not you guys, you know?
I know. Normally I'm the gushiest of all gushers.
And I thought they carried the torch, the Nerd Appropriate torch, very well during the interview.
They did, the spirit of it.
Yeah.
They were equally gushy, and I think they did a great job. And hopefully they do more. I want to see them do more stuff. And so maybe we can, you know, dangle a carrot and they can do more interviews in the future.
I'm pretty sure I tweeted this out like right after the interview too, but Marissa Meyer and her husband, two of the most gracious people, like just awesome. They were super conversational, you know, for a 30-minute interview. We actually hung out with them for about 45 minutes, I think, just talking, and they're good people.
Yeah. I honestly, like, as soon as it was over, I was kind of like, I just kind of want to hang out with them.
Yeah.
Like, aww. Hopefully at the next show, like we hang out and, you know,
we requested drinks at the next interview, I believe.
Grab some food or something. But
yeah, I also learned that you can preview like some of the chapters on Kindle. So if you search for Marissa Meyer on Amazon and find her books, I think you can read excerpts of the books through your Kindle device. Yeah. Awesome. So that's pretty cool. So if you're on the fence, check it out. Definitely support her.
So Ash, I was super, super jelly of this next one, 'cause you interviewed, Lizzie Kaplan, my buddy, Lizzie Kaplan,
your buddy, Lizzie Kaplan. Yeah.
I don't actually know her, but
yeah, so I briefly talked about it
on
episode 114, but roundtable interviews are weird because you don't conduct them by yourself with, you know, the people that you're talking to. You have a group of people. So I was actually there with a journalist from Hulu and another person from Collider and I think maybe one or two more. And we all kind of sat together with the cast of this film called The Sidekick. And The Sidekick's a short film about a superhero sidekick that hits 40 and kind of loses his mojo, I guess, and starts to really suck at his job and discovers that he doesn't really have any skills and other than being a sidekick. And what is he going to do with his life? And so I sat down with the director and, of course, the writer and star Rob Benedict. And then Lizzie Kaplan was there, who plays the love interest in the film. Richard Spate Jr. is in the interview. Jordan Peele from Key & Peele is in the interview. Jason Ritter was in the interview, and he plays this kind of cocky replacement. And Josh Myers is in the interview as well. There's a lot of different voices to kind of contend with, so this one may be challenging to listen to, but it's a lot of fun. And there's actually some questions near the end about Party Down and maybe some Freaks and Geeks or something too. So if you're fans of those series, you get to hear Lizzie Kaplan's passion about wanting to revisit that franchise. So that's pretty cool.
How's it going?
Great.
My name is Jason Ritter, and I play Kid Loco. My name is Rob Benedict, and I play Max McCabe.
My name is Lizzie Kaplan, and I play Bailey.
And so, Bailey. Rob, you came up with the story.
Yes.
And were you a superhero fan growing up as a kid? What kind of made you want to write
this? I always loved Superman, Batman, Spider-Man. Like, that's as deep as it went for me, but I was a huge fan of all of those characters and the movies, subsequent movies made about them, and the comic books. So, and I always found myself identifying with the sidekick character. Like Robin was that's because I have a brother who's 6'4", and growing up in his shadow as the little guy. I mean, literally, and I'm little now. Like I was little, like thought there was something wrong with me.
No idea you had a brother who's 6'4".
And my brother's 6'4". He like set records in basketball at high school, and I came in and they're like, oh, maybe theater. So and so I always identified with the buddy, you know. So that was kind of where that all came from in my mind.
When you established this world, you wrote a superhero story, but in a very comedic way, in that it seems as though the characters in the universe all are living in a very normal world where there are superheroes.
Yeah, exactly.
What kind of made you want to write out a superhero story?
Well, you know, the whole thing for me was an allegory for sort of where I was at in life, and I think ultimately I think it's an allegory for anybody who's sort of getting older and feeling, questioning what their real purpose in life is, you know, and like where, what do you really, what's your purpose? And for me it became, like when I turned 40, I realized that being an actor was all I ever have done and all I've known to do. It's all what I trained for. I feel like this is all I'd ever really be good at, you know? So it was that realization, like, oh my God, it's too late for me. If I quit acting, I'm not qualified to do anything else, you know? No one else would take me, you know? There's some young whippersnapper who's much more qualified. So anyway, so that's kind of what it came out of. And so the fact that it was, for me, kind of an allegory, I wanted these to be real people, not some... I didn't want to create a fake city. Like, for me, it took place in L.A. It just was in L.A. where being a superhero was just another profession. Like being an actor, you know? Yeah, I was just saying, like, I wrote it with these people in mind and went out, like, on a limb to ask them to do it because, you know, these are all very busy actors and they're all friends of mine, but it's such a passion project for me. I'm like, you know what, I'm gonna go for it and, like, just, you know, this is my dream cast. And, like, they were all able to do it. I mean, it was amazing. Like, and look at all these people. Like, they're fantastic. So, yeah, I really did write it for all of them, you know, in mind, and it was great. It was such a gratifying feeling that they were able to do it.
Now, you talk about this is where you were in your life, mm-hmm. and you come from, you know, the fandom,
yeah.
Supernatural,
right.
Which I'm sure affected you a lot.
Right.
Do you think that affected his character as well, his fans? Was there like a fandom? Part, I mean, who's going to have bigger fans than superheroes?
Right, exactly. Yeah, there definitely, like, early on there was, like, a draft where he... sort of had, like, he had started abusing his, like, he was kind of, like, stoned one day on the job. Like, he just kind of let himself go. And, like, some fans see him, and they're like, what's going on with Max, you know? So, yeah, there was definitely that element earlier in it. And, yeah, the whole supernatural thing has really opened my eyes a lot more to the fandom. And being here, too, at Comic-Con, which I was here last year, too. Like, that, you know, that whole thing. And absolutely, like, people... people's association with superheroes, but also, like, I think in Supernatural is this, the thing that people identify with is the real person in these characters. Supernatural, like, they talk to people like each other like real people, and that's why I think it really connects with people. So that was, if anything, that's what, how it had its effect on me.
Yeah.
I guess I am. I meet the Max character when he's in the depths of despair, and I know how the story ends. You know, I help him see that he is in fact a valuable guy, and a valuable guy to me.
Aww. I make him feel the exact opposite.
Yeah,
when he gets booted out of being a sidekick to his hero, I'm the new guy who comes in and makes him feel not valuable and replaceable and all that kind of
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, he's the young whippersnapper.
Yeah, kid
logo.
Exactly. And basically I had the exact same uniform, but shinier.
Yeah, they made the exact same uniform, and they made his on purpose really shiny and new. Yeah. Mine's all dull and
faded.
And
yeah.
We actually took a picture, a great picture. I don't know if you've seen it.
I did see that. That was so funny.
It's Ron Livingston, yeah. and then us on either side, like, posing, and he's all shiny.
Did you draw any characters from, like, the new kind of heroes? Because you're the new, fresh sidekick. So were you drawing from, like, Robin, the new Robin, like, fresh Robin, or any characters that you...
It was, I mean, I think, you know, because my character is such a, you know, he's not a good or nice person, so it was more about him just, it was all about the presentation. It's all just, I'm a good guy, you know, and what, like, imagining what that looks like when you read a comic book or something like that. He has no real desire to be an actual good guy. He just wants to be a
yeah.
big, famous hero.
Yeah, exactly. We're thinking in the TV show, if, you know, Michael and I have all these ideas about spinning this into a show that Kid Loco, like, the fame goes to his head, and he's, like fur coats and pulling up in a limousine.
That would be amazing. Yeah.
What's the last time you saved someone?
Yeah.
I've been busy.
Photo shoots, yeah. So. You missed the session this morning. Slept in.
So here at Comic-Con, pretty much anyone can be a superhero, because they can dress up as their favorite characters. If you guys were to dress up, what would you go as? What would you cosplay as?
I would dress up as this tomato, but without the petals pulled off. Yeah,
just the red.
Just like a perfect tomato, not uh-huh. one that's been. That's what I would be, and it would be crazy. With like flames.
Everyone
would
be like, "Who's
side.
The tomato?
Whoa! Did you see that tomato? It looked real, but
it like
was
no
big.
Leaves.
Yeah.
Would you be Ritter?
That's tough. It's really tough because you know there's some that are just. Have been my favorites for all time, but I feel like there will already be people doing better ones. But you know, Spider-Man has always been one of my favorites, and but I don't know. Maybe I would be like Rusty Brown from Chris Ware's graphic novels, and see if anyone.
Wow, that's
gets
it.
Someone will always recognize.
Yes, that's what, yeah. There's very specific. Things here too, like people are dressed up and like, what are you? And they're like, hello, I would be like, my problem is, I was saying this earlier, like some of my favorite characters don't have great costumes. Like I love Luke and Han Solo. I would love to go as Luke or Han Solo, but when you like, I went as Han Solo for Halloween one year, and my buddy was Chewbacca, and we got split up, and then I'm just like a dude with a vest. like, and wait, what are you? Like, oh, right, so I'm like Harrison Ford.
You know? That's funny.
So, yeah, so I've got to rework that.
Would you guys be willing to wear your costumes out and walk around?
Yeah, did you bring
100%.
It?
100%. I didn't. I should have. I know, we would have rocked that.
We would have rocked that.
My hope is that next year people are dressing as those guys. That this goes huge.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Where are you hoping to place the show?
Well, we right now we see it as like a cable show or even the internet. Mm-hmm. We really like the like Burning Love model, you know, mm-hmm. which started on the internet and then switched over.
Sure.
Michael, every time Michael and I sit down and talk about it, we just, you know, like the Kid Loco story, like it just spins into episodes. It feels like that's what it wants to be, and it would be great if it could be, like the Burning Love thing is cool too, because you can get actors like these guys that are working all the time to come in and do one-off.
Right.
And then, go, you know what I mean? And it's that kind of world where this you can introduce a new character, and then they're gone, and you don't see me again, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Do you feel like the mediums are different, like web versus TV? I mean, House of Cards just got nominated for an Emmy.
Yeah, it's amazing. So. It's a different landscape now than it was, you know, even 2 years ago, so... Yeah, it's totally legitimate to do it that way and doable, and you can keep it kind of edgy. This isn't a network
control.
Show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have Kickstarter now where you can have the fans help fund it.
That's
absolutely.
True.
Yeah.
How do you guys feel about that, Kickstarter, and what young directors are doing and young producers are doing?
I think there's really good time and place for it, and it's really awesome to see it working out. Like the Veronica Mars thing was amazing.
Happened in like 2 days.
Yeah, but I get like 7 Kickstarter requests every day.
Every
it's like enough. Like, it's
the movies Kickstarter.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
My favorite thing with Kickstarter is like if with musicians, if they're trying to record a CD or something like that and they're struggling, I'm basically saying, I want to buy your CD, and I'm buying it before you make it.
Right.
And so that.
How do you know you want to buy the CD if you haven't even heard it yet because it hasn't been made?
Well, because maybe I've heard them play live, or I've heard their other CDs that they've already made before that.
I don't know if I agree.
Or I saw the Kickstarter video and it sounded beautiful.
That's probably all you do. You just sit at home.
Service Kickstarter.
$50
what can I give money to today?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
I've only done it twice, I've been happy.
But it was for $10,000.
And the music video turned out wonderful.
What about the Party Down movie?
I don't know. I mean, we're hoping that it happens. Clearly the Veronica Mars thing was made us like renewed hope in it. But I'm not sure what that wants to be. Like, talking about the Burning Love thing, I don't know if Party Down wants to be a movie or like an Arrested Development kind of thing.
That'd be fun.
That would be amazing. I mean, just getting to do it again would be amazing in any form. Thanks, man.
Thanks, guys.
I'm Josh Myers.
I'm Jordan Peel. I play Sidecar Willie in The Sidekick.
No.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I have to talk more about that. No. Yeah, okay.
And I'm Jimmy T.
Not
as exciting of a name, perhaps. No, got no reaction from the table. Sidecar Willie, everyone's like, oh.
Josh, it just Jimmy meant you had to do more work to come up with it.
No, Jimmy T is just a prick. He's an uppity sidekick who is rubbing in the face of Max, who's just lost his job as a sidekick.
He has to be one in every movie.
Yeah, no, and that always seems to be me. That's what a play.
Yeah.
That's
a good question. I mean, Robbie Benedict wrote the movie and directed it, starred, not directed it, he produced and starred it as well. And I think he sort of wrote the characters towards us. Like Josh was saying, I mean, we all play sidekicks that are in this little sidekick community. And I think they're slightly referential about, to people. I mean, the character that I'm the sidekick of, I don't know if there is a parallel to him. He's like a super fast, sort of Mad Max-y motorcycle guy. It rings true. You know, I can't point to an actual guy, but every different superhero had a little bit of a different style. Like, they kind of came from a little bit of a different world, and so did their corresponding sidekicks.
So I'm assuming sidekick.
I actually don't. I have the leather jacket. I've got the goggles. The sidecar is implied. It is implied.
Don't you have like a bad like hip or something from riding the sidecar?
I was internalizing
that. Okay. It was good. I mean, that's acting. You'll see it when you guys can watch it.
Talk about the costume. Did you guys have any sort of like input over what you had to wear, or did they just present it to you?
I mean, mine was pretty much straight, tight, white Lycra. My choice. With, like, I think just a white sort of, underpants sort of situation going on. But I didn't have a lot of input.
Certainly it was lofted up to us, like, whatever input you guys have, bring it. You know, this is Rob's a good friend of ours, and so there's a lot of trust. I mean, he trusts in our experience, ability to kind of put the piece together, a character. But I mean, I think a lot of it, what we work off of well, is, you know, seeing the outfit and that kind of helping us create the character. So it's a lot of tights in this movie, and it kind of worked. I mean, when they showed me when they first unveiled the Sidecar Willie thing, it was like, all right, that's it. I see him. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you put me in white Lycra and then give me a spray tan and sort of like a little tinting in my hair, it's amazing the jerk that'll come out. It's just so naturally.
I didn't even realize you had a spray tan in that.
Yeah, it was. We were. It was a slow start to the shooting day, and it was the first thing we wanted to shoot, and I was complaining, saying, if this is what's holding us up, we might not need the spray tan. And Rob said, like, no, we definitely, we need the spray tan. So we held shooting so that I could be
and then
a few shades
just for me to not even notice.
Right. I feel like they did 4 or 5 days, maybe. I worked a day. You worked a couple.
I worked a couple days, yeah. And both days we were in there maybe 4 or 5 hours, something like that, sort of a shoot. Just, you know, two scenes, you know, come, but there's just, that, you know, there's one of the nice things, and I still haven't seen the movie, the film, I still haven't seen it, but one of the cool things about it is there are, you know, so many funny people coming in, and I think part of the world is getting that variety, and, you know, so there's like, kind of everybody has a scene.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. We're gonna go to. I'll be seeing it the first time with everybody else, and I'll be laughing the loudest just by virtue of at myself.
Yeah.
Just because somebody has to.
Did you guys rehearse at all, or was it just like on set?
Who was on set? I mean, the scene that I was in was with Jordan and Ike Barinholtz, myself and Rob,
in a
laundromat, all friends, you know, for between 12 and 16 years, so it was not something that we needed to really work through. We were pretty confident going in that it was going to be all right, and yeah, it was very loose. We certainly got what was in the script, but then we got a lot of things that weren't on the page.
A lot of the humor in the film comes from just taking this heightened reality and just placing it in the most casual, real conversation, real people with real problems, real flaws. So it's sort of, you know, it just it doesn't play like any other kind of superhero world you've ever seen. It just it plays on such a small scale level, and you know, which is kind of, you know, I guess satirical about the whole concept of sidekicks, which is like, you know, there's this dude running around who is admittedly inferior to their partner.
Yeah, and he knows he never aspired to be number one because he knew he didn't have it in him. Which, like, yeah, so it's that kind of guy. Please. Yeah. Well, I think if it, you know, I don't know if it would go, you know, web series, TV series, Adult Swim, something like that, where maybe you could have 15-minute episodes, but I feel like Rob would love to kind of expand and have, like, the Sidecar Willie episode and the Jimmy T episode and have it be the type of show that, you know, you could get a lot of good people to come in and do a week and have their episode and then maybe pop in here or there, but have that freedom to not sort of lock actors into something and also have, you know, the joy of like, oh, hey, next week I'm doing my sidekick episode.
You got to think that, if it went to series, it would just be, you know, a revolving door of, you know, comedic talent coming in, just playing a new character, and just, it would be an ever-expanding world.
Yeah.
I think Sidecar Willie actually is a super villain.
He is.
Yeah, if I recall.
But they get along.
And they get along.
And Martin Starr plays a villain as well, but they, you know, they're all friends. It's like they all went to the same high school, so like, right, oh, we know you. Yeah.
Another part of the allegory, if I remember, is kind of like, it feels like actors, right?
Yeah, I think it's like a bit of that. It's a bit of Robbie Venner's midlife crisis. So, which he wrote an article for HuffPo on, about that exactly.
Hello.
So,
yeah.
Hi. Well, hey. Oh, thank you.
We're moving.
Robbie's here. The boss is here. The boss. Excuse us.
Okay, so this next interview was with Oliver Vaquer, who plays Robert Lutece on the game Bioshock Infinite. Of course, one of the Lutece twins. we actually interviewed Jennifer Hale earlier in the year, who plays the other Lutece twin, and now we are talking to the male Lutece twin. Oliver was awesome. We bonded after a long walk around the Comic-Con floor, actually looking for Jennifer Hale. They wanted to say hi to each other before Jennifer Hale's panel, and I was like, oh, I want to say hi to Jennifer Hale too. And so we kind of walked around together for a while around the con floor looking for Jennifer Hale, who we eventually found like 1 minute before her panel. So I got to say a quick hello and snap a couple photos, which are up on the site someplace. And then we got down to her interview, and he's an incredibly funny, gracious guy. And it was great to meet him. And I thought it was cool
that he was a gamer.
Yeah, he's a gamer.
And so he had some opinions.
Really interesting history. And it was his first Comic-Con. So he has that really like that vibrating excitement, you know, that you only get the first time that you go there, that like bewilderment of like, what is this place and what is going on? And I think the second that he walked into the hall floor, he actually ran into Lutece cosplayers. So it was like this great, like, you know, welcome to Comic-Con. Here are people cosplaying as a character that you voiced. So
that's awesome. That's really good.
So if you are a fan of BioShock, you'll definitely love this interview. Or if you have an interest in voice acting, hang out, listen to this one. We are here with Oliver Vaquer. It is San Diego Comic-Con 2013. It is, what day is today?
Today's Friday.
It's Friday the 19th. And we're here to talk a little bit about voice acting and a little bit about BioShock and a little bit about just the voice acting community. So how are you enjoying from what I understand is your very first Comic-Con?
And that's about as articulate as I can be. It's awesome. It's everything my 11-year-old self ever wanted it to be, and it's just, it's eye candy, it's overwhelming, it is, that's it, that's about it.
I mean, it's interesting, because Comic-Con is a place where people of all different fandoms kind of gather at the same time, and I think this year there's over 130,000 people here from all over the world, and all celebrating different things, and for the most part, they all get along, so that's always good to see. You told me a story just when we were walking around, looking for Jennifer Hale for a few minutes. when you first walked into the convention hall, can you tell our listeners kind of what happened when you first walked into the convention hall?
Yeah, well, it started with the fact that I never got a confirmation email from Comic-Con that I, with a barcode. I knew that they didn't need to verify my identity, and that was fine. But once we got here yesterday, the data lines of 4G and 3G and 1X and were so jammed that I couldn't get on my phone to even find that. So, of course, I went into a panic that I wasn't going to get into Comic-Con and nothing was going to work out. And my friend Courtney Taylor, who's Jack in Mass Effect 3 and Ada Wong in Resident Evil, she said, calm down, take a breath, you're going to get into con, relax. Sure enough, we went to the place, the ID, there it was, had the badge, boom, we walk in, and right into two Lutece cosplayers. And it almost felt like I was being punked, you know, but it was just that, it was kismet. It was the best welcome I could ever have gotten at my very first Comic-Con. For a project that I'm incredibly proud of.
Absolutely. So let's dive into BioShock Infinite and kind of how you ended up getting that role. Because you, again, briefly told me a quick story as we were walking around about how you ended up voice acting. Because you're relatively new to voice acting in video games, at least. Sure. So tell us a little bit of how you landed the role in BioShock Infinite.
To be honest, it's not a terribly complicated story. The audition came through my agents. It was one conversation, one person having a conversation with themselves, didn't know what the game was for. It was called Icarus, and then there was a callback, and right before the callback I was told that it was for BioShock Infinite, and that was the point where the gamer nerd in me took a deep breath and allowed the panic to set in, and then said, wait a minute, you know exactly how this is supposed to sound. You played the games, you love the games, there's a rhythm to it, there's a feel, there's anyone who's familiar with it just knows there are eerie undertones even in the most unthreatening of moments, and that's just something that Ken Levine crafted.
The aesthetic of BioShock is unique
to games. I mean, it definitely has a vibe unlike any other series out there. It's very dark, but there's still this strange humor to it as well. It's almost like a darker version of maybe a Tim Burton story or something to that effect. And I really love the world that's painted in. The voice talent is incredible. We're lucky enough to have Courtney Draper on, and we talked to her for a while, and she's incredible. And I know she and Troy Baker, actually got to record in the same room. Did you and Jennifer Hale actually do that?
We absolutely did. There was not one session where we weren't together. So as a noob, I was spoiled rotten. I had done a few games back in New York when I spent a lot of my time for Rockstar. And, you know, I would have come in and, for instance, DJ Boy Sanchez on Liberty City Stories. And that's, you know, that's just me being, you know, in my room yelling at my mom while I'm doing the whole thing, right? And then that's by yourself. And then Warriors is the drug dealers. And that's just like, hey, man, what do you mean? And that's by yourself. And then Manhunt 2, where I'm an inmate being lit on fire. And that's certainly by myself, you know what I mean? And I'm also done for the rest of the day after my voice goes through those calisthenics. It was incredible. And because the characters are based on stoppered characters for the most part, there's a rhythm about the way that they were written where it's almost impossible. You know, without any spoilers, you know, the Lutes twins, you know, there are moments where they finish each other's sentences because they know each other so well. And you can't fake that. You have to find that rhythm. And it got to the point where it was such a, I mean, Jenna is such a seasoned pro, and she is so good at what she does that it was effortless. And our sessions were not long. They really weren't. Like, once Ken got us into the rhythm, we just went, and we got it, and then we played. And then he let us go, and he gave us some freedom. He's like, you guys know your characters, just go. And so, and as I said, I'm surprised it's not done that way more often. And I've talked to a lot of game directors, and I've talked to a lot of developers so far in this whirlwind, mind you. I mean, I'm so new to this, and this game is, the fandom of these characters is, it's incredibly overwhelming, it's incredibly flattering, and it feels really good because the product is awesome. And a lot of people ask that question, did you guys read together? And I think, especially when it comes to things like the accolades that Last of Us is getting, where the work that Ashley and Troy and everyone did in that game, I mean, you're acting in a black box theater with another actor. Like, it's something we don't get to do as voice actors. When you work with another actor, different things happen and real things happen, and it's just a different product.
So what exactly is your background? Because you mentioned coming from an acting background, but how do you find the transition into voice acting? And also you mentioned briefly the community. So what has it been like? What has your reception been like at other events that you've been to? And what does it feel to be part of this voice acting community? Because there are a lot of people that support one another in this community.
I have to say that, you know, it's funny. I'm meeting a lot of people for the first time at Comic-Con. And now we've all met on Twitter. You know, I met Eric Bauza, and I met Yuri Lowenthal, and I met Tara Blatt, and I, you know, all these people that I've, who are all awesome, and who we've communicated with Twitter, and this and that, and I know their work, of course, and was actually surprised that they knew mine, and it's flat, and I met Troy Baker, really, for the first time last night.
Wow, that's incredible.
You know, and so to finally meet all these people, it that's when you really feel a part of the community. You know, that's when you really feel like I'm a part of something really cool. I mean, we have the greatest jobs. We really do. It's fun, and it's love. You know, and I made a joke with Ken Levine. I said, you know, I don't tell yourself this, but I would have done this for free. You know, it was so much fun, and it was. Now, that was then. This is now, by the way. I will not do Bioshock Infinite for free or any other Bioshock entity hereafter. It feels really great. It feels really great to be among people who are so good at what they do and have been doing this for such a long time. I feel honored to be a part of their circle.
And you mentioned, again, while we were walking around, that you love games and you enjoy video games. Yeah, so what are some of your titles even growing up or in the past few years that are some of your favorites over the years?
It's funny, there's always this question about, I'm so ADD that you know, people have always sort of posed the question, are you a Zelda or are you a Mario Brothers? You know, I'm totally a Mario Brothers kind of guy. Last of Us was so difficult. So difficult for me. It really was. I came down on myself a lot because I'm not good at stealth. I'm a run and gun, let's be honest. Like, it's okay. I just don't have the patience, you know. Albeit, it was amazing. I am not a survival horror guy, and I was engrossed. Completely engrossed. You know, and one of the things that amazes me also is everybody wants to race these two games. They want to race Last of Us. They want to race it with Bioshock. Like, what's it? You know what? I think they're both great and they're so different. It's apples and oranges. It's, hey, what's the best picture? Ordinary People or Avatar? You know, it's just like, whatever floats your boat, just enjoy them. Stop racing them. Let's just have fun. The fact that the end of these platforms, we're getting three games minimum. I mean, the minimum this year, we've got Bioshock, we've got Last of Us, and you got GTA 5 coming out, which looks amazing. And that's just three of the unbelievable games coming out as the swan songs for these platforms. To be a part of this time period and the transition is amazing. It's just amazing.
So how do you think... No, you did. You did, in a very roundabout way. I mean, you said that you're more of a Mario guy, running gun guy. Yeah. I mean, but in terms of voice acting in games, and I bring this up with a lot of voice actors that we have on, it seems like in the past, even 5, 6, 7 years, the quality of voice acting in games has increased exponentially. What do you kind of attribute that to?
I really don't think it is a hard question because I'm so new, I can't talk about what was. I can talk about what my experience is now, and it's the relationships. Period. Voice acting and voiceover in general is a very lonely job. You know, I was a commercial. I was the voice of Dairy Queen for 8 years. I was the Dairy Queen lips. You know, David Duchovny nailed it from me. Like, you know, yeah. We did the whole tortilla, nailed it. Like, that was our commercial.
Yeah.
And that was my voice. But that was all alone. I don't have somebody else in the booth with me. I have the creatives who are amazing, and I have the other people, you know, all the people, the ad agency, and you've got your agents who are telling you where to go and what to do. But as an announcer, I was alone for a long time. So, and again, those New York video game experiences I told you about, as Guy on Fire number 3, like, you're alone, you know. So the more we all get together and the more we know each other in ways outside, the more free we are to work inside, and it becomes a more collaborative process. And that's all I know, and I feel blessed to know that, you know what I mean?
To me, as a fan, in the past, I think 3 or 4 years of gaming have become my favorite. I mean, I've been playing since I was a little kid, and the quality of storytelling and the quality of the voice acting has made me become an even bigger fan of games before, which is one of the reasons why we started the site in the first place, just because we got to the point in our fandom where we're like, we can't just handle like being on the outside anymore. We want to know more. We want to talk to these people and get to know them and things of that nature. Where do you see, and again, this is a very broad question, so I apologize, but where do you see games going with the next generation of consoles as an actor? And do you think that, you know, roles are going to be even larger? Because in the past, like, protagonists in games, there's just a lot of, like, you know, if you go back to Doom and Quake and those, there's just a lot of grunting. And now you have main characters that have, you know, hours and hours and hours of dialogue. So do you think that trend's going to continue and we're going to get these big, broad tales?
I think based on what Irrational did with Elizabeth, and based on what Naughty Dog did with Last of Us, I think they've changed the way games are not only played but appreciated and now accepted. People are now finding the artistry in the games. It's not a question anymore. Are you going to go see a blockbuster, or do you have the patience to sit down and live through a 16-hour blockbuster, if you will? You know, and have the same emotional moments and be so engrossed in something. You know, I was afraid probably 15 of the 16 hours of Last of Us, and I was just too exhausted to be tired for that last hour. And then with Bioshock, the fast-paced adrenaline rush is something completely different as well. You know, and so, you know, and you get on the skyhook and you're on the rails and you're going and you're trying to find, how do I target this and how do I do that and how do I come and what's the best? It's a different way of thinking. So it just, again, but the more information and the more immersed you are in these experiences, Yeah, it's changed the way things are appreciated, and now with the new technology. As an actor, scary, I just right? as an actor, just like in Black Box Theater, just like in any movie, just like in any television show, you can't fake it. You can't fake it anymore.
So what would you, if you were to kind of, this is a rather generic question, so I apologize, but if you were to kind of look into the future and pick some roles for yourself in gaming, what kind of roles would you like to play?
I absolutely love exactly what I have done in BioShock. And again, this one's tough because with BioShock, you know, I don't exist without Jennifer Hale, and vice versa in this game. You know, that's just what it is. But I love those characters. I love that.
Is it that they could be brought back really easily too for future titles?
And hey, look, and that's all up to the people and the folks. And look, hey, they're fun to inhabit. You know, they're really fun to inhabit. That said, those are my favorite kind of characters, the ones that pop in. You know, if I think about movie roles, I think about my favorite, which is Gary Oldman's Drexel in True Romance. That is, to me, the epitome of most of my career theatrically, also in games and animation. Those are the things that's what I love. You come in, you have something so well written and so well designed and just... We had never seen the pictures of the Lutece twins, by the way.
Oh, really?
We didn't know what they looked like. We didn't know anything. Nothing. Ken was like, oh, I'll show you. He's like, I'll show you the next session. I'll show you the next session. That's not really what he sounds like, but that's how he sounds like in my mind, mocking me as he lies to me. And we never saw them, you know. And it's just amazing. It's amazing. These people design some of the most incredible stuff. And we get to come in and we get to... bring them to life in a certain way, but it's all there. It is all there, and we just breathe into them a little bit, and it's hopping into just those side characters, and that's just what I love. I love to be able to grab an accent, you know, just completely transform. Completely transform and have some fun. That's not to say I wouldn't do a franchise role. That's just to say that right now, I'm just, you know what? I really love what I do. And so what comes, comes, and I don't question it. I just go with it. I love it. I love it.
So that was 115, guys. That was all of our interview goodness from Comic-Con 2013. We hope you enjoy it. Ash worked very hard. I was watching him run around the con with his microphone and camera in hand to get all this stuff done. So hope you enjoy. And you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/nerdappropriate. We've got a bunch of new pictures going up, including a bunch of stuff from Comic-Con of a lot of the cosplaying and people that we ran into while we were there. Follow us on Twitter at nerdappropriate. And, of course, you can always email us, Matt, Scott, Ash, or Hillary with one L at nerdappropriate.com. And we are reading Ready Player One on Goodreads. I think at this point everybody should be about halfway, maybe a little further, closer to three-quarters of the way done. We're going to set up a Google Hangout or something of that sort to talk about the book, and we'll record it and probably post it to the site and do some fun stuff with that as well. So thanks again for listening, guys. That was 115, and we're out.
Bye, everyone.
Just the way you said it just killed me. Me and this other guy did the front end.
I don't care.
And I was like, what? Sorry.
It brought us joy, Matt. It was funny.
I don't care.
Let us continue then.
Lettuce, get it?
See, now
I work in produce, and lettuce jokes make me so angry.